An interview with Governor Victor Attia at his office in downtown Portland, Oregon. The interviewer for the Oregon Historical Society is Clark Hansen. The date is August 18th, 1993, and this is tape 53, side two. In February of 1986, your last year in office, you announced a plan for a school finance reform, and from what the paper said, it said that the plan would establish new tax bases for all the state's school districts equal to each district's operating levy for the previous year. Is that right? And it would eliminate, except in emergencies, the authority that districts now have to seek excess levies outside the amount of their tax bases and limit the automatic annual rate of increase from in tax base permitted under the Oregon Constitution from 5% to 6%. They a lot of people cried about the change from 5% to 5%. Does 1% really make that much difference?
It depends on who you talk to.
Uh-huh.
There's some people that think 0% is plenty.
Mm-hmm.
That's foolish to think in terms of that. Even at low inflation,
mm-hmm.
there is that kind of growth. And you have such a diversity between school districts, some which are plateaued in terms of attendance, and some that are losing attendance, and things like in Washington County exploding in growth.
Mm-hmm.
So you know you can't really fit one shoe to fit everybody. It just doesn't work that way. The concept of establishing the school base at where they are now was this matter of trying to treat all school districts the same.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier in our tapes, we had talked about the 1.5%.
Right.
And 1.5% squeezed everybody to 1.5. And I told you then that there were some school districts less than 1.5. And so they wouldn't even know what happened. Then you run into a school district like school district 1, which is 3%. They lose half. So I'm saying, okay, the voters said, this is the budget. We voted that in. I'll take that. That's what the voters said. And if it's 3% or 1.5 or 1.25 or 2% or whatever, wherever it was, but that's the base. So that was the theory behind that. The other was, again, consistently, without fail, trying to control the growth. And that's the basic concept mm-hmm. behind it, the principles behind it.
Well, reaction to your plan was mixed concerning the reduction in the automatic increase in tax bases. Some people felt that it was unfair to districts that were recently revised and had adequate tax bases and did not provide for the inequity among the districts. I think this is what you've been referring to.
I don't agree with that. But, you know, everybody's got their own oxygen being gored.
Yeah.
The point is that we were going to say, okay, you that have it. We're not changing anything. So you know how I would find that we're changing. Mm-hmm. We're not changing anything. We're just taking what the voters put in. If they had established a tax base, fine.
Mm-hmm.
That's there already. Way back in our tape, I told you about one of the real effective tools that happened was done very quietly. Almost unnoticed, but was extremely successful. That is, established the school bases. And that was after the safety net failed and Jason Bull was born. I said to Jason near the end of the session, why don't we just say that if you go to the voters for a new budget and it turned out, I've forgotten what the cycle was, one or two times, you would have to, by Oregon law, go for a new tax base. So it sort of took out the school board in the sense of they're trying to establish a school, you know, a new tax base. They can go to the voters and say, the state says we have to, so you can shift the blame. And where there was then about, I think, 10 or 12 school districts with realistic tax bases at that point, I forgot, but the number had increased gradually, and I think more than half of the school districts was, at that point, was something like 20 or 30 school districts had tax bases, and that all just happened because of that bill.
Hmm.
But still, there was a lot out there that didn't. Had some big ones. So here again, trying to establish the tax base, and at the same time limiting growth. Mm-hmm. Now you recall I also mm-hmm. said that OEA is a major player in the fact that we have a ballot five, and that we really haven't been able to solve it. And that's because they wanted a crisis situation. If you don't vote for this budget, the school will close. Well, once you establish a tax base, that argument's gone. Mm-hmm. The school won't close. Maybe at some reduced level, but it's not going to close. And so it was that crisis that the OEA liked. They never said it. I'm just telling you what my observation. And so I think I would credit them, meaning, that's probably unfair to say OEA because of a lot of members, that certainly the leadership of the OEA was the reason that we find ourselves in the soup where we are now.
They said that they wouldn't support your plan and were gathering signatures for their own 5% sales tax with a 1.5% property tax limitation. Your plan didn't have a sales tax included in it, did it?
No, it wasn't going to change anything.
We
weren't replacing anything. This was not what you... I always said that property tax relief is how you really look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Some said, raise a lot of money and cut my taxes down. I contend that if they, incidentally, this is not the first time I was wanting to limit growth. If they had accepted, I think if I figured that in a, when I proposed it, and I've forgotten, I'm trying to remember now, but if they had been adopted at that point, it would have saved the property taxpayers, I don't know, $400 or $500 million by limiting growth. So what's property tax relief? I say that's property tax. That happens to be out in the future,
right,
versus cut my taxes now. I still contend that's relief. So again, it's in the eyes of the beholder.
Well, Nora Paulus and the educational community felt that they hadn't been consulted by you and that you weren't seeking a referendum by your plan, through your plan. You responded at the time that time is short and that you had the background to draw up the plan.
A little cocky, but that's the answer. I mean, you know, how long do you have to go to school? Now, at that point in time, I've been going to school for 27 years, you know?
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Being on a tax committee all that time and then repeatedly asking for and going through plans and some abortive and not really successful.
But politically, was that a wise move?
No. And I suppose there's some fault to it, but you know, to me, I say, it will bite you on the same bone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why do we have to bring a whole lot of people to chew the bone? There it is, and the bone's been chewed on. There aren't really any complex answers to this problem. The complexity was by the insertion of our ballot measure 5. That created a complexity by not providing added revenue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If they'd been provisioned for added revenue from somewhere else, we would have no problem at all. So what we have now is ballot 5, which says cut the local property taxes. Now state, take the income tax that you're collecting
mm-hmm.
and use that to replace the cut that we made, which of course reduces the amount available for state government. So those are the kind of shifts that are taking place. But, you know, it's nothing. If we talk today, there are those who want to have some replacement for ballot 5.
Mm-hmm.
It is not a complex issue. It is not. There's only three ways to get large amounts of money.
Mm-hmm.
Property tax, income tax, sales tax. There is no other way to get large amounts of money.
Of course, some people claim that more should be cut from the budget.
That's foolish. Foolish in the sense that I think all government mm-hmm. can be reduced. But to say cut out the fat and that will solve it, there's not that much fat. Maybe there's 10% fat, maybe 15% fat, I don't know, 5% fat. There's fat, but there's fat in any business you go to. I'm looking across the street, this building, and these office buildings, and there's fat in their business, but I know that. There's a bank across the street, there's fat there too. But there isn't that much fat.
Right.
You see what I'm trying to say? And so it's a sort of a simple answer to a very complex problem. Cut the fat, that'll take care of it. No, it'll help take care of it, but it won't take care of it. So all that's left now, if you're really going to do it first, property taxes, obviously. People want them reduced. They've been reduced. They voted for 1.5, so that you can't use. Income tax, Oregon's tax rate is among the highest in the United States. We want to grow economically. There's no political or economic sense to raise the income tax, at least sufficiently. So now you have to raise it way up in order to get that job done. What's left?
Sales tax.
So you see, I'm getting to, when you talk about Northern Paulus and have a study and all that, why? There aren't any really unanswered questions out there. Over all those years, just about everything has been exposed.
Then is the unanswered question what people's priorities are?
Yeah, where they think that they will have benefit more. Like I told you, we'd spend hours upon hours on trying to revise the basic school formula. And we would do it in a very academic atmosphere. And then we'd have computer runs. And the first thing that I would do is see what happened to my Washington County schools.
If sure.
It hurt them, then it was a lousy plan. So all of a sudden you lose science and you get down to politics. And so I guess, but well, yeah, you say to me, was that a mistake? Probably, you know. You got to get people in, and I'm too anxious for this, and I'm in my last year.
But is that a major difference, that the fact that you are in your last year, that you can propose things that might be unpopular and not have to worry so much about the consequences?
That's possible, but that's not really what's in my head. In other words, I can do this with wild abandon.
Right.
The hell with it. I'm not going to run for re-election. I'm going to run again. That's never been my attitude. I've told you many times.
Sure.
This is not a game. And I've always felt that whatever we do or I do is going to affect somebody. And so I take it very seriously. I don't let that interfere with me. As a matter of fact, this lame duck, as they call it, the moment I was reelected, if you want to act like one, you're a lame duck.
Yeah.
You know, you can't run for office again. I had 3 years prior to '86 to do all these silly things. That doesn't make a difference. They're not going to kick me out of office. But you see, my history didn't show that. And I'm not doing it in the last gasp either. I'm saying, hey, I've been trying to solve this for now 7 years. Give it another shot.
But, you know, other people, other Republicans, say, for instance, Bob Smith, who there's some speculation that he might be running for governor, has suggested that there's no need to have higher taxes to be able to solve the state budgetary problems.
I like Bob. Bob would make a great governor. I don't agree with that. Bob has not worked as intimately with government programs as I have. He was speaker. He wasn't a member of Ways and Means. But even a member of Ways and Means, see, the Ways and Means members only get certain pieces of budget. This subcommittee handles this, and this subcommittee handles this, and that subcommittee. So hardly any member of the Ways and Means Committee look at budget. And so I'm saying I don't agree with that. I've dealt so intimately with all of state government. Cocky or not, I think I know what I'm talking about.
But is it feasible for somebody to run for office on a platform of higher taxes?
No.
So So what does somebody in Bob Smith's position do?
Bob Smith is not Clinton. I
understand.
And I want to give you an illustration. Okay. If you look at Clinton's statements prior, during the time he was running for office, versus Clinton now that he's elected president, there's two different Clintons altogether. Mm-hmm. And so he proposed the largest tax increase in the history of the United States. But when you listened to him when he was a candidate, he wasn't talking about anything like that. He wasn't telling the people, you elect me president, and I'm gonna pass the largest tax increase in the history of the United States. He didn't say that. That's what he did. But I don't want to make that comparison because Bob, I think, is saying what he believes. I think he would find it different once he became a governor. I think he would be a great governor. I really do. He's the kind of guy that I call has his head screwed on real good.
But for any person running for the office of governor, since this is the major crisis that our state faces, certainly financial crisis, if not all over crisis, how can somebody address the problems, whether it's Barbara Roberts or Bob Smith, without following the same course of logic that you've just walked me through?
Honestly, you mean honest campaigning?
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't run a campaign for somebody else, but Piketty is running for governor again, currently under the circumstances that exist at the time, right now. Mm-hmm. And I would be saying to people, look, I know enough about this to know what I'm saying, and that we are not going to be able to have a good system of education, including higher education. Nor are we going to be able to have the kind of state that we've had before if we don't do something. Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that something is going to be approved by you, talking to my audience. Mm-hmm. But the only thing that remains, and I would say, is a sales tax. Now, my particular history did, is with one exception, I've opposed a sales tax. But I'm saying what we want, what I want as a governor, what I hope you want as a Oregonian, is a state that was as stable as it was before ballot measure 5. And if somebody said to me, well, we can cut the fat, I would give them the same answer I just gave you. Mm-hmm. There is fat to be cut. There is not enough fat to be cut to do what you want to do. Mm-hmm. And I have to be honest and direct with them. Just yesterday, I was dealing with some matters in the Lake Orion Golf Club and some people around complaining about the amplified noise and fireworks. And so I knew what their complaints were. I said to the board when we met last, why not set up a meeting with these people and talk? And so they wrote a letter. So yesterday, someone in the newspaper, this Westland newspaper, called. And was asking me about a rather confrontation. Mm-hmm. You know, well, what are you going to do about this? This people have called her, and you know, don't you care? And I said to her, I had already told her about the letter I'd written. I said, why you ask a question like that? Why would I write a letter saying let's have a meeting? Why would I bring it up before the Board of Governors? If I weren't, why do you ask that question? Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying to you is that, you know, I could have backed off and said, well, yes, we are concerned. I just said to the assembly lady, why do you ask that question? I don't understand why you ask it. There's the proof right here. Finally faxed her the letter. Well, all I'm saying is that people will appreciate that. Now, you know, she probably didn't think that she was asking a dumb question. You know, she didn't think so. But now I think she knows that she did. And I don't mean to be dumb questions by people, but to be honest with them, I still believe this, firmly believe this. Going back to our way early in our conversation, when I first ran for office, you tell people what you think they want to hear, and then do all your good deeds once you're elected. No, you don't do it that way. I still believe that. And if I go out and tell people what I think is the right thing to do, and they don't elect me, this is a representative form of government. They don't want me. They don't want what I have to say. So I lose. So the sun comes up the next day. But you see, some don't take it quite that way.
Yeah.
I know one fellow who ran for Congress. I've never seen a guy so crushed for such a long period of time when he lost. And I'm saying, well, I don't understand that. Why are you going through all of this torment? You know, so the people didn't want what you have to say.
Well, people take it as a personal rejection.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
Sure. You know, I was, when I ran in 1974, I wasn't elated by losing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't say, hey, hooray, I lost. You know, nobody can do that after you give so many months of hard work on a campaign. But I just said to myself, and I know I did for the tape earlier, that they just didn't want what I had to say.
Mm-hmm.
They liked Bob Straw better than, you know, like me. I did have the comfort, and I believe very firmly that what I was saying was where they were. And maybe that's what gave me confidence in 78, because I knew where they were. I thought I knew where they were, and obviously I was in 78. But, you know, I wasn't crushed. It took me a while to heal up and rest up from that whirl that you go through in a campaign. But I certainly was never despondent about the whole thing. Well, that's me, but I've seen others, as I see, just totally destroyed.
Well, don't some people get involved in politics, maybe not necessarily consciously involved in politics, but for they greatly desire public acceptance and to be liked publicly.
Yeah.
And as that kind of, with that kind of a basis to their
it depends really on, well, on the extent of it.
Mm-hmm.
All of us, you, me, forget politics. You know, we don't want to be disliked. We want to be accepted, whether it's among our own peers, our friends, and business, doesn't make any difference. We all have egos.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the nature of a human being. But some have bigger egos than others.
Mm-hmm.
Some are really big egos. And that happens to be the kind of people they are. Tom McCall had a very big ego. I don't say that cruelly, that's just really where he was. Jason Bo had a very large ego.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen some with, you know, super big egos. I don't want to be hated by anybody. I didn't pay that much attention. I don't really know where I ended in terms of favorability. I know it was down from my high point. But I looked at Governor Roberts' favorability rating, which is, I've forgotten what it was, 17-18%. I mean, that is really something unheard of. I said, gee whiz, after 8 years, I wasn't that low, you know. And I use that expression, friends may come and friends may go, but enemies accumulate. And you do, you know, pick up barnacles on the road.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you do something somebody dislikes, so next week you do something that the next person. So now you got two people. You know, that's how they accumulate. But that's nice to hear nice things. You don't want to hear people that are really upset with you. In politics, though, occasionally I get some pretty nasty mail, but I just write that one off.
Mm-hmm.
That's just an aberration out there. Somebody really doesn't like me. There's some might not like me, and some of them really don't like me. I saved that letter. I still have it somewhere in a scrapbook. Some fellow wrote to me, dear, I don't know whether I was a senator or house member. They say, dear Senator Tia. And then ended with very truly yours. Those are the two nicest things they said in the letter. And in between, it was awful. I mean, really bad. And
did you ever have any threats?
Hmm?
Did you ever have any threats against your life?
As a governor, but not as a legislator.
Uh-huh. What were they? Have we talked about that?
I don't really know. Yeah. I tell you that these were things that the state police would pick up.
Uh-huh.
And as a governor, I'd go somewhere, and then I'd notice there'd be more than normal
state police
around. Then I'd turn to Lon Holbrook by 8, and I'd say, okay, Lon, what's up?
You were kept abreast of all these various...
No, I wasn't. I said to Lon, I'm not going to worry about this. You worry about it. And I didn't.
Uh-huh.
I just was not going to have my mind cluttered with that sort of thing. That's an awful load to put on a young man, which I did. That's a terrible load to put on a young man. But there was no point in my worrying about it. I just wasn't going to worry about it. So, but I would sort of almost chuckle when I'd say, okay, Lon, what's up? You know, then somebody would write or somebody would call or whatever. They'd intercept this or whatever intelligence they find. And I don't know if I told you, I'm going to divert for a second, really a funny story. I had one state police aide, Lon Holbrook, lieutenant, and when we would go somewhere, and the story I'm going to tell you now relates to Eugene, then we would have some of the state trooper and Eugene go to this, in the case the Valley River Inn, just get the lay of the land, where's the room we're going to go to, and that sort of thing. So we're heading down toward Eugene, and we're getting closer to Eugene, and I can tell by listening to the state police radio that something's up, but I'm not quite sure what it is, because there's no description, but you can tell from the traffic and all. Then finally we get a message, would the governor stop by the state patrol office before he goes to his event? Now that's pretty unusual. Not why, would you just please stop by? So we stop by to the patrol office. Well, the story was that they had a stakeout at the Valley River Inn for some really bad dude, a drug guy, and he's a pretty rough guy, and you know, it's guns and all this sort of. They had a stakeout for this guy at the Valley River Inn.
Gee.
And the funny part was that now without all of this knowledge, it sent the state trooper in his state police car, and he parks there by the Valley River Inn, and he walks in uniform. And all of a sudden, these undercover guys, plainclothes, say, what the hell are you doing here? You know, you walk in, big as life. Well, he says, I'm just kind of looking over for Governor Attia. Governor Attia? You know, they got enough problems as it is.
Right.
Staking out this guy without being bothered with the governor.
Yeah.
So we waited around for quite a long period of time. I was late arriving at my event. Finally, they said, okay, go on in.
Did they explain that to the people, or could they?
No, I didn't, and I just said, unfortunately, I'm sorry I'm late, and I wasn't telling you. This was a Federation Republic of Women. I didn't want to tell them they had a stakeout with some bad dude.
Yeah.
And there might be some shooting going on. So, but that was a funny story. I can just imagine how upset these guys were, because these were plainclothes, undercover, stakeout, and all of a sudden the state police car drives up with a guy in uniform, you know?
Yeah.
And the governor's coming.
Yeah. Anything else like that?
No, that's the one I can remember the most. There was an anonymous letter that came in, and we pretty well identified who that person was, and he was in the Bend area.
Bend area?
Bend area.
Oh, Bend area.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so whenever we go up there, we don't have added security, just because this guy, we knew about him,
uh-huh.
And he'd written an anonymous but very threatening letter,
mm-hmm.
And we pretty well identified that's who he was. So there was security. Nothing ever happened as a result of it. We were never chased or shot at or punched at or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not the kind of governor that would excite people that much emotionally, you know, excite that kind of deep emotional feelings. I'm just not that kind of a person. So that was, you know, there's always some crackpot that wants to do something. Incidentally, there is no absolute guarantee, no matter how much security you have.
Mm-hmm.
And the quickest explanation is nobody has more security than Reagan, and yet he got shot.
Right.
In a community where it's illegal to have guns.
Mm.
So that's Washington, D.C. So, you know, there's no absolute guarantee. the presence of state police is just sort of keep away the, you know, spur of the moment kind of person, you know, mm-hmm. may want to jump the governor. And a lot of times it wasn't Vic Attia, it was just the governor, you know, the guy that's the head of this thing. But the first time this occurred, I may have mentioned that on the tape,